My sunglasses. Hi, I'm Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. I never drank in a bar this bright. ever. One of my favorite places in the French Quarter was a place called the Bastille, and it was so dark in there, and they had painted black over all the windows that, you know, if it was daylight and we were still imbibing, which we had a mind to do much of the time, somebody would crack the door and that light would seep in and we would just, we would just lay down in the bar. It just hurt, that sunlight, just hurt. I don't know if you remember when sunlight started to hurt, you know, it was, and when the shower started to hurt, I remember that too. There's a few of you in here, I'm sure, but I'd like to thank you for your hospitality. There's a lot of people in this room I love. I just, I feel so blessed to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I, you know, it's, who's watching Billy, by the way? They're watching the children. Are they watching Billy? Watch Billy. He's got almost 25 years. He needs to be watched. He's got less time than me. Couple months. Coffee black, please, Billy. I got off the plane, and it was nice that Bob was there, and I went and had dinner with him and Julie and got to meet the family and the girls and Michelle and Dale, and it was nice to take a deep breath and be with my people because I still live in a world and function very well in a world I don't understand. Much of the time, I don't even want to understand, and I come in here, and I can take a deep breath and just be with my people, my family of understanding. And that's so, that hits my heart right away. When I can sit in the room and hear Chapter 5 read, it just fills me up. And it totally lets me know I'm in the right place because I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous on August 20th, 1975, looking for sobriety, looking for a new way of life, looking to have a sponsor, make friends, have commitments, be a worker among workers. I mean, it was, please, I was dropping out of everything. I didn't want life when I came here. And I really identified with Susan, who's must be watching Billy. I was a low bottom drunk too. I mean, I didn't start that way. It wasn't what I wanted to be when I grew up. It was just where I ended up. And I didn't care. And there's so much, alcoholism is so cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient. And it centers in the mind, as it talks about in the big book. I've been physically sober a long time. I'm emotionally sober. I have to do a lot of work to stay emotionally sober, and I've been spiritually sober because I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous at 7 years of sobriety, and nothing has ever been the same since that happened to me. But alcoholism centers in the mind, and it is alive and well and rested and ready for me much of the time when I wake up in the morning. It's been fed and had its morning coffee, and it's like the vulture on the end of the bed, waiting to pick. And so I struggle with emotional sobriety still much of the time because my brain tells me things that are so true. And I listen to them sometimes, and it makes life very untenable on some of those days. But I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to be with the people that understand me. And there's something that just fills my soul. And so I know I'm in the right place. I grew up in Iowa. That was my first resentment, and from that point on, I loved the book, The Princess and the Pea. I knew they had dropped me off. They were coming back to get me. I'm the only alcoholic, and they're all fine still. I keep waiting for somebody to fall out of the closet. I had a cousin that got close, but he went in the service and straightened up, and so I am the odd one out. I am the oddball. I am the one that they talked about for many years in whispers in the kitchen or whispers in the hallway or even well into Alcoholics Anonymous, they would whisper things like, Sharon's an AA. You know, they just, yeah. You too, huh? That's just, I bet you drank bong wine too. I bet you're one of those. It just hit the black hole there for a minute. Okay. something about the heat. In Las Vegas. I got almost kicked out of Las Vegas once. That was an interesting. I didn't even realize it until it was 1969. I was coming through and I was on the end of a speed run. And we were sure that they planted something in the car. You know? We were sure. And the hitchhikers with us had been picked up and taken to jail, so we had to go to jail to try to see if we could get them out, and we were sure they planted something in the car. So for 8 hours, we went through that car, you know, looking for a seed, you know. And they asked us please to leave town and not to come back, and I was underage, and they asked me to leave one of the casinos, and I didn't want to come back anyway. But here I am, we were in Iowa. Okay, this is what happens when I work a long day. But my family is a great family. They're still a great family. I was the one that needed something extra. I don't think alcoholism cares who you are. It's the greatest equalizer in the world. It doesn't matter what you do, who you are, where you come from, if you have it. You know, it is a disease that will take everything from you. And the thing about my life, I don't know about yours, was that I gave willingly to alcoholism. I gave it for alcohol to work in my life. I kept moving the line in the sand. I gave pieces of my soul. I took a lot of geographics. I started running away from myself very early. And I don't know if anywhere along that path in my life, and I had many people that were there to help me, somebody would have said, you know, if you continue on this path, you're very artistic, you're very musical, you have a lot of ability, a lot of talent. It's been proven. You are not going to paint another picture for 35 years. I would say, who cares about canvases and oil paints and joy and what my soul did when I got to create? Who cares about that? Pour it now, you know, to the top. Neat, no salt, no lime, that tequila gold right to the top. I don't know, somewhere else in one of my travels, if they would have said, you know, you continue to go down the path like you are, doing what you do, breaking other people's hearts, harming people in your way, tornado roaring through people's lives, as it talks about in the book, that you're not going to have any more dignity. Your dignity and your innocence are gone the rest of your life. I'd say, who cares? Pour it to the top, make it neat, no salt, no lime, and buy him one too. Now that, who cares? Alcohol was powerful, made me feel omnipotent. It filled me up. It made me bulletproof. It allowed me to be what I wanted to be. It made me not care. It made all the voices in my head shut up. And I just got focused and centered and strong and powerful. And the Catholic Church couldn't do that for me. My parents couldn't do that for me. The well-meaning people in college and all the psychiatrists and all those books I read and all people that were there to help me along couldn't do that for me. Alcohol did that for me. And when I read that word King Alcohol in the book, it was like, oh, that's it. Alcohol was king in my life. And I gave everything up for it as I went down the path. And you know, when you do that and you don't care and you walk over people and you walk around people and you hide from people and you do what you need to do, it's pretty soon, you know, you're not welcome anywhere. Pretty soon you break the hearts and you can't stand and look at your father's face anymore because he can't look you in the eyes and he has that set look with his jaw and your mother just seems to shake her head. My mother was always on my side. I'm the second of three daughters, and then there's my brother's last. And my mother and I always bonded. And boy, it broke my heart at the end when my mother would just, she'd just say things like, you just break our hearts when you call home. You know, and I couldn't remember Christmas, and they would try to find me at these bars I was working or living with my birthday present or Christmas presents or... And I was living in the French Quarter at the end of my drinking, and they would come down, and they found me. They went to Texas. They came across, and they found me living above a biker bar with this guy that was the love of my life. I had met him with a carnival. That's a long story. Because I was living on an organic farm, growing organic things, and did the pot deal, but I forgot the pot, so I joined the carnival. That was in northern Wisconsin. I ended up in Louisiana. And thrown in jail for drugs, and with this guy, and he had a pet skunk, and so the skunk and my dog, we all went to jail, and so 2 years later, I'm still in this relationship where we loved each other for 2 weeks, and then we were in it for 2 years, because nobody wanted to leave first, you know? And we were living above this biker bar, and I had a new black eye and my platinum blonde wig on and my dress with the zippers everywhere, and the skunk was running around and the snake was loose, and my father and mother are knocking at the door. It's not really what you want for your little girl, I can tell you that. And they came in, and this guy was nasty to my parents, and they took me out to eat, and I remember I don't know if he went out to eat with us or not, but my father had that set look on his face, and he couldn't look me in the eyes, and my mother just cried into her baked potato. That's what I remember, was her tears rolling into her baked potato, and they had no idea that there was alcoholism in my life. They didn't know what was wrong with me. I'm so grateful today that I know what's wrong with me and that they know that I'm okay. That they know I'm okay. If I get nothing else out of this, my mother sleeps at night soundly. Doesn't have to worry about getting a call at 4 a.m. they found me somewhere. And that she'd have to get on a plane and go claim her daughter's body. Overpaid. So on the days that, you know, I get a little bit stressed or ungrateful, I just need to come sit with you, take a deep breath, and know how lucky I am. And I know that there's some new people here, and I just want to tell you how lucky you are that you know that you have found Alcoholics Anonymous, because not every alcoholic gets the opportunity to sit in a room and rub shoulders with other alcoholics that have found the solution. So I want to welcome you here. My parents found me living there with this guy, and, you know, we were still together after that. But I sat in the Mousetrap bar after they went home that day, and I ordered my gold. And I don't know how much I drank that day, and the head didn't shut off. Oh, it just didn't shut off, and I needed it to shut off. I needed it to tell me, who cares about them anyway? My life is so much bigger than that little Iowa life they have. It didn't shut off, and it didn't lie to me that day. And more than anything, I wanted to get in the back seat of my mom and dad's car and just go back to Iowa with them and start over, but I knew nothing would change. I knew nothing would change, and I didn't know alcoholism. And I had another, 2 years of drinking after that, and alcohol didn't always work for me from that point on. I couldn't count on it. This guy that I was so in love with, his parole officer found him, and so they moved him back to St. Louis. And we had been busted for drugs together, and so I was a convicted felon, and they didn't understand it was just for my personal use. They thought they got me for possession and sales because there was so much stuff. And that was in southern Louisiana. It wasn't a good place to go to jail. And I liked the way Susan said that, separated from alcohol. That was where I was separated from alcohol, was when I was locked up. But I met the guy that was in for murder, who was making his own, apple wine or something horrible. But you could, you know, hold your nose and drink it and watch the cockroaches crawl up the wall and eat the grits and do what you had to do in jail. But So this guy and I were together for 2 years after we got busted for drugs, and then his parole officer found him and went back to St. Louis. And what happened was, I was sitting in a bar one night talking to my friends, and I think they were mostly my drag queens that night, and they wanted my clothes. So we moved me out, and I went up to St. Louis to find this guy, and they got all my clothes. They were very happy with it. And I got in the car and moved to St. Louis to find this guy because he was my true love. Now, we had had knife fights, we had had the cops called on us, we had lived above this biker bar, they used to come up and break it up, then they would just come up and watch, you know, it was just entertainment for them, and so I went to St. Louis, and I found him, and I was in St. Louis about 4 months, so I was working 3 jobs, the things that would help me find truth and keep me awake so I wouldn't miss it when I was drinking. Were really working then, so I wasn't sleeping much, and I was out there looking for him, and I found him. And he got off his Harley, and he took off his helmet, and he broke the window, and he pulled me through by my hair, and he spit in my face and said, if I ever see you again, I will kill you, as a police car pulled up, or it would have gotten nastier. And that's how I let go of the relationship. That's me. That's what I do. I hang on, and I just suck the life right out of it until it's dead, or I guess somebody pulled it out of my hand. But that's the kind of loyalty I had. You know, I had that kind of loyalty to alcohol. I am a loyal Leo. I will hang on it until it is just gone. And I've learned how, in Alcoholics Anonymous, to make that part of my character, because it's still part of my character, part of an asset today instead of a defect. I don't hang on to things quite that hard anymore. I've learned how to loosen my grip with the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous on how to let life happen. I am not the director. I don't sit in the back of the bus with my head anymore. I have learned in sobriety to sit at the front of the bus where God is driving. And I send my head to the back of the bus. All those voices, all those people that I named, all those yakety-yakety in my brain, I sent them at the back of the bus, and I just don't listen to them. My sponsor says, turn it down like a bad radio station. So, but alcohol stopped working, stopped shutting my head off. Alcohol wasn't going to be there the last 2 years to count on like I used to count on it. And I ended up back in the French Quarter, and I tended bar at some great places and some real sleazy places, and I love the sleazy places. And my last bar tending was on Lower Decatur Street, and you had a dance with me for a dollar, and you bought me a drink. And that was what it was. And I got fired for having a bad attitude. I had some physical problems with alcohol, too. I had had pancreatitis, and my gallbladder had been removed, and I had liver splotches on my face that didn't go away, and that was probably when water started hurting, and I don't know, that when my long hair was stringy in a lot of the later pictures of the last of my drinking. My sister had a few she sent me, and I was bloated and toxic, and I was now unemployable, and alcohol wasn't working for me all the time. My blackouts would be 2 or 3 days. Sometimes I wouldn't black out at all. Sometimes I wouldn't get drunk. Sometimes I would get just snot-nosed, sad, crying to, you know, like country western songs, drunk, throwing up on your shoe. I mean, somebody look at me and go, God, I thought you were a good time, get away from me, you know, after a couple of drinks. And that's what alcohol did for me. That's what alcohol did for me at the end of my drinking. 1975, my friend Michael, who was a friend of mine, and drank like I drank, and he was a bouncer at Pat O'Brien's in the French Quarter. It was Mardi Gras. He had a gun. It was Mardi Gras Day, and I remember walking down the street with him, and we had been partying all night, and we were really, really loaded, and he had a gun and stuck it in somebody's face, and I said, oh, Michael, it's Mardi Gras Day. Put your gun away. That's my reality, you know, like it's some toy thing or something, and I'm in and out of a blackout. I was in that brownout stage where some things I remember, some things I don't remember, and I guess we went to my apartment, and I guess I had gone out for more wine, and I guess he had gone to the balcony and started shooting at people off my balcony. So, of course, the police were called. Now, Michael knew every cop on the beat in the French Quarter because he was a bouncer at Pat O'Brien's. And for him to do something like that, I believe he just went to the edge and went over the edge. And I like to party with people who like to go to the edge. My blackout, when I came to, Michael was shot and he was dead by a French Quarter policeman that had been called, and that this guy had a gun, and I didn't really ever know what happened with that. I felt very guilty for a long time because I was the last person to talk to him alive, and I don't remember it. And there's a couple of days I'd like to take back. That'd be one. And another day was with my father. And my father, I was the bright spot in his life for a lot of years, and my dad played the accordion. He was from Czechoslovakia. He was an incredible man, and I played the accordion too, just to get my dad's attention. You know, three girls right in a row, somebody had to do something a little different. And I played in the Boddicker accordion band, and I would wear those red cotton piqué dresses that we all had made alike, and we had these black and white Titano accordion, and I had the keyboard here, and we would sit on these hay bales, and they would put us on these big hay wagons, and, you know, they would have town parades, and we would be the float and the Boddicker accordion band. She would be up there directing us, and we'd be playing, you know, beer barrel poker, or whatever, you know, the flying bumblebee or whatever those things were we played. And my father would see me, and he would just light up. He would just light up. And, you know, here I am, busted for drugs in Bogalusa, Louisiana, brought out of jail in handcuffs, thrown into this room where my father sat, who had hired this attorney, because he had heard that I was in this jackpot, and he had flown in from Iowa, rented a car, and found me and hired a lawyer. And I sat there next to my father that day, inches away from him, and nobody hugged each other, and nobody said much. He just sat by me in front of this lawyer, and I asked my father 8 years ago about that day. I didn't want to run out in the first 2 years of my sobriety and bring it up again. Listen to your sponsor when it comes to amends. So 8 years ago, I got to go home for a special event, which was their 50th wedding anniversary, and my dad and I got to spend some time, and I asked him about that day. And I said, I don't remember much, Dad, other than just being there and seeing you and noticing that, you know, you didn't look me in the eye, and there we were again, sitting shoulder to shoulder, and nobody could look at each other or tell each other they loved each other or what's wrong with you, or I wish I could help you. And I said, what did I say, Dad? And he said, you told me you weren't guilty. It wasn't your fault. That's the way I live my life. And if I could take back another day, that would be another one. That would be another one, because he was so worried and concerned, and nothing he could do, because nobody knew alcoholism. Nobody knew that I was suffering from alcoholism. Now, there was one doctor at one point when I lived on that organic farm up in northern Wisconsin, and my gallbladder quit working. And they took me, and I had emergency surgery, and he said to me, you shouldn't look like this at 21. Do you use drugs or alcohol? And I looked at him, and I said, I'm organic. And that was as honest as I could be. So maybe he spotted something, but that was the only one I heard. I had gone back to the Catholic Church. I had tried to talk to the priest. I got drunk with a couple of them. You know, I fought with them about ethics, so much that we were screaming at one another in the church. So I didn't go that route, because at one time I felt comfortable in my faith. But that was another thing I could cross off my list and justify and drink at. And 1975, I ended up in New York. And New York to California, California back to New Orleans. And I had alcoholic stuttering and DTs, and I didn't know I needed a lot of fresh alcohol in my system. I didn't know. I just drank. Nobody took my alcohol away. I remember being at Fort Walton Beach at the Officers Club on the 4th of July, and I was the only female in there, and I had shots lined up for half the bar, bought for me. And I had to go in the bathroom, lock the door, and take the quart out of my bag and hit on it, because I couldn't get enough. And from New Orleans, I was couldn't get my old job back. Nobody seemed to want to hire me. It seemed like my alcoholic friends didn't want to be with me. And I met somebody going to Hawaii, and I'm out of here. I couldn't. Now, I had in my backpack the book Be Here Now by Baba Ram Dass, and I thought that I was a free spirit. And he just wrote another book. It's called Still Here. It was given to me for my 25th birthday by a friend of mine. I loved it. But I made it to Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood, and I never got to Hawaii. And what happened at Barney's Beanery was I saw this girl, really drunk. Bartender called her a cab, and I didn't know what was going on, but then I realized she was going to an A&A meeting, as we all called it. And she was too drunk to drive, so he called a cab for Chris. And she was drunk with a big book under her arm, feeling her way out the door so she could get in this taxi to go to A&A, and we all gave her a toast. All gave her a toast on her way out the door. And that was going to be my connection to Alcoholics Anonymous, was this woman. I ended up on a bike going to Palm Springs. Somebody said they wanted to party. They asked me if I liked Harleys. I said I loved them, and I got on, and we went. And at the nightclub, they started to pull away after they dropped me off, and I asked them why. I said, I thought you wanted to party with me, and they said, nah, it was windy going through the desert. We needed a little extra weight. Thanks. See ya. Now, I had become extra weight. And I was in a blackout that night, and I don't remember too much, blessedly. And when I came to, I was in an apartment somewhere, and this wasn't a DT, and this was really happening to me, and I was being beat up, and I was being sexually abused, and I was being physically abused, and I was taken outside of town and rolled off the side of the road. It was July 27th, 1975. And I was laying face down in the sand. And I remember hearing the car door slam, and that survivor that we all have inside of us kicked in. And I got up a little bit because I thought, they're coming back, I gotta move. And I heard a voice. The voice said, get up, I wanna live. And I thought, who said that? Because I didn't care about living anymore. I really was, it was done and over. And I don't remember much about what happened, but I guess I passed out in a lawn chair by somebody's pool. Another 2 feet, you'd have another speaker. Norm Alpe used to talk about seconds and inches, and every single one of us have those seconds and inches that we're lucky enough to be here. And a gardener found me, called, you know, the police, and I guess I ended up in an ambulance, and I don't remember that, and I came to on the gurney. I came to on the gurney in the hospital with the doctors over me, preparing me for surgery. And I heard that voice again. It said, you know what? Those guys didn't put you here. It's not your dad's fault, Catholic Church, your sister, the Mensa, George, who broke your heart at 18, yada, 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 down the list. It said, you did this to you. I don't want to hear truth. Not now. This is a real good victim thing I got going here. And I heard it. And something happened inside of me. I believe there was a spiritual shift inside of me because I laid in that hospital. I was in there for 2 weeks, and they brought me a little glass of wine on my birthday, the nurses. I had my birthday in there. And they had a party, and I remember looking at that wine. I mean, I'd been on morphine and some other stuff, which was, you know, made time just go by. But I remember looking at that wine when they left, and I thought, I'm going to get that wine when they go. And I stuck a straw in it, and I stuck a straw through the wires of my mouth where the tooth had been because I had my jaw broken in 3 places. And I started to drink that wine, and it repulsed me. The taste repulsed me. Now, I had drank bong wine. I had drank wine. I had drank, beer with everything in it. I hate to even tell you, but at one point, with some green chartreuse in a rock glass, I kind of came up, and then it went back down because I was in a chug-a-log contest. So, you know, I've drank stuff with everything in it, and for that wine to repulse me was, I paid attention. So I don't know what happened, but something had shifted within me, and after I got out, I lived above a liquor store, and the guy was buying me wine every day, and so I was drinking the wine, and it was like drinking water. There was no more fun in it, there was no more excitement in it, there was no more high in it, and he said I had to leave. And they had caught these guys, and I had to go back to a court case in Palm Springs. I was tired. I was tired. And that's the beauty of it, was I was done. And I hope if you're new, you're done. I hope if you're new that you didn't just waltz out of bed this morning going, I think I'll go to AA today. I hope you hurt. I hope your life sucks. Because I was done that day, and the joy of it was he tapped me on the shoulder and said, you've got to leave, you're depressing me. I had hated that tap on the shoulder. It had happened to me before, and I'd like to be one step ahead. I quit, you're fired, I'd like to be right there. And so I called my mother in Iowa, who always loved me, whose heart had been broken by me, who had gotten a phone call from someone in that hospital but didn't tell her where I was, what hospital I was in, and told her what had happened to her daughter. And then 2 days it took her to find me. My sister and her made phone calls, found me. And the seconds and inches of this moment always touch me because she would have done anything to save me. But when I called her that day and asked her for some help, she didn't say yes. She said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? And my mother doesn't even know where she got those words. My mother's never been to Al-Anon. She just knew it was time to let me go. It was my day. The excitement that I feel was that was my day. Now, the girl Chris, who I called next, who was the lady from Barney's Beanery with the big book under her arm, is not sober today. She is dead. She had 7 tries here. And on the 8th try, she didn't get back. She died at St. John's Hospital. She was 31 years old. So I don't know how many ins and outs I've got. I don't know how many you've got. I just know we're here. Hang on. Having a hard day? Grab the seat. Talk to somebody. Wail midnight. I've had a lot of come on midnight days. Because when the sun comes up in the morning, everything seems a little bit easier. When I share it with one other person, it cuts it in half. I hang in there through the tough stuff because I don't know. I don't know. But it was my day because my mother had let me go. I had nowhere to go. I was tired. And I called that girl, Chris, because her number was staring at me. And she said she couldn't help me, but Suzanne could. And Chris wasn't sober that day, but she recognized alcoholism. She recognized the disease because she was one of us. And I called Suzanne, and Suzanne sent her two beautiful babies over to pick me up. I didn't know where we're going or what we're all about. I just said I needed help. She said, put your drink down and put your joint down. I thought, how does she know? How does she know I had both right here? And I sat on the steps of that liquor store, and these two beautiful girls came and got me, and they were in this bright car, and they had bright teeth and bright hair. And they stuck me in the back of a Volkswagen, and I couldn't get out. And it was hot, and I was detoxing, and I know they were sincere because I hadn't bathed in a while. And they took me to this church, and they talked incessantly about themselves, and I thought, when are they going to ask me about me? I mean, that's what I thought. I've got this wired jaw, and I can't talk, so I've got this newspaper clipping from the Palm Springs Herald in my pocket in case they say, oh, my God, what happened to you? Tell us your story. You know, I could, since I couldn't talk, I could pull out my newspaper clipping and unemployed bartender from New Orleans. I mean, it was really a great clipping. I still have it. Nobody wanted to see it. But they took me to this church, and I thought, oh, here we go. Then I'm going to have to explain myself and take the potential test and sign away something for eternity and forever, and I'm going to have to tell them I only do a day at a time. And there was a man at the door who was well dressed up, and I want to compliment you on your greeters. You could not get lost in here. Because that's what he was when I walked into my meeting, was that secretary who was at the door with a suit and a tie on, and I paid attention to him. A man that looked like that hadn't been nice to me in a long time. And I was sure he was going to put me in the kitchen behind him because I looked so bad. He put out his hand, and I thought he was going to pull me in and say, come clean up in the kitchen, and when you look a little better, you can come sit with everyone else. That's what I thought he was going to say. As I walked up to him, he stuck out his hand, and he said, welcome. And I wasn't ready for welcome. Not at all, because it disarmed me. Now, granted, I couldn't talk, so I'm thinking all these things. My first 3 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, not a word. Wired shut. It was a blessing. It was an absolute blessing. My ears opened. They used to say, take the cotton out of your ears and shove it in your mouth, but nobody had to tell me that. So here I'm at this meeting, and I didn't understand, and I don't know how they knew that it was my first time or how I was new, and I loved it over here. Cassie raised somebody's arm for her. That's what they did. Like, just kind of very neatly just lifted my arm and, okay, what is this? And the man that stood at the podium said he waited for the spaceship to land and said, you can come home now, Bill. And that tiny ember, tiny, tiny ember of wanting to live life inside of me, the great fact deep within each one of us, because we have it when we get in here, was fanned a little bit, just got a little brighter, just touch by coming to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and identifying. I didn't know that's what I was doing, but I felt something just for a moment. And they took me home, and I lived above this liquor store, and their sponsors had said, wait for the lights to turn off before you send her upstairs, and that's love. With a detoxing, smelling alcoholic in the backseat of a Volkswagen till the liquor store lights turned off, sharing incessantly about themselves as I sat there. Oh, shit. And then they sent me upstairs and they said, don't drink and use in between, and we'll pick you up tomorrow. Now, you can go to a new meeting. I went to new meetings. I came to and realized I had been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so out of it. And I'm so glad because the fight was gone. I am a fighter. If it is not time for me to go or not time for you to go, we're gonna discuss this. If I want something, I'm going to go for it. I am a fighter. And the fight was gone, blessedly, because I brought myself to meetings, not drinking, not using in between, and pretty soon I realized I had 31 days of sobriety and I didn't have to raise my hand. They had moved me out and I slept on women's floors. I didn't know I was assigned here for a week and assigned there for a week. And I don't know what would have happened if I would have walked into a group where they said, you know, gee, it's great to see you, but we'll, you know, hang in there, we'll see you next Tuesday. You know, come back next week. They didn't do that. They rallied around me. Now, the old-timers were working with other newcomers that were probably smelled nicer, but they were sending all their babies over to work with me. Go learn how to work with a newcomer. Go work with that girl named Cher, you know. I finally got my real name going here, but there was a woman named Pat, and Pat had 8 days less than me. When she came in, she got all the old-timers' attention. Everybody seemed to want to talk to her. She was crying all the time. It was like, oh, just give me a break, you know. Turned on the waterworks, and she got all the old-timers right around her all the time, you know. The old-timers, they had like 2, 3, 4 years, but they seemed like they're old-timer, these women. And it was like, here I am with these people, and they're just doing their third step and, you know, starting their fourth step, and they're in their first year, and they're whisking me around. They don't know what they're talking about. They're crying half the time, and this lady, Pat, gets all their attention, and it just seemed like every time they'd read chapter 5, you know, I know that they whisked her through the steps for some reason. She did 4 and 5 real quickly, and she'd look at me and go, you know. Because she had done her 4th and 5th step. She had done her 6th and 7th. She was well into amends, and I hadn't even started my 4th step. And I knew she was just, you know, lauding it over me. So I would think about drinking many nights, and then I would think, no, then I'll have less time than Pat, so I think I'll hang in here. You know, I wanted to have those 8 days on Pat. No matter what, I had those 8 days. And I just went to Pat's 25-year party a week ago. We still get to take cakes together. And they did a quilt for her. And my little square, I put an 8-ball on it for those 8 days. never going to let her forget it. But I remember when I finally did my 5th step a week before my 1st birthday, and it seemed like I was waiting for Pat to look at me. Please look at me tonight. Please look at me. Give me that judgment, you know. And I just smiled at her because I had done my 5th step finally. It was a week before my 1st birthday, but I finally finished it, and I finally sat with my sponsor all night on Venice Beach, and I read it to her, and I was just comfortable in my seat that night, proud of something I had done. I hadn't done something like that in years and years and years. I was proud. I had gotten a little bit of self-worth that night. And when I dropped my sponsor off that morning after my 5th step, we looked up at the sky, and this very pure thought came in my head, which was angels would live there. It was so pretty, the sky. I thought, oh, God, that's corny. Who said that? You know, it was like I cleaned out enough garbage that I got to have a little God shot, a little thought. And I've been doing a lot of step work ever since then. I've had sponsors that have been active and ahead of me. She was great with me. She was angry, and she had learned how to live in the world. She was married to a guy named Don, and I was with this guy named Al who was sponsored by Don, and Al would call Don, and I would say, okay, now pass the phone to me. And, you know, I'd say, Don, get Janet on the phone. So Janet would get on. She'd call me herself, and she'd hang up on me. And I had this wild mind, and she just got tired of hearing about it. She said, you got to lock it in the trunk of your car. I was a food waitress. And she said, you're not making any tips. You got to learn how to smile and give them an Al-Anon smile. Don't tell them how you feel when they ask. They don't really want to know. You just tell them, you know, because your tips will get better. You know, really, believe me. And so we worked on my Al-Anon smile for a while. I locked my brain in the trunk of the car. I really would go out, and I would open my trunk. I would put my brain in. I would shut my trunk, and I would go punch in. And the guard at the Marriott Hotel where I worked would look at me. And he looked at me like that for a year and a half, and he never asked, you know, because I would come out of work, and I would open the trunk, I'd put it back in my head, and I would get in my car, and I would drive, and we'd talk about my day, you know. All my but I got this car. It was a Chevy Malibu, and I think about how close I came to drinking over this car, how important it was. And you know, first of all, I had to put a chair in the back because I was low-riding. The seat was broken, so my sponsor got an old chair and made me sit up to drive, and I got a license and insurance, and I'm still with the same insurance company an AA member sold me, you know, years ago, and everything in the same name, and then I went and got it painted. I went to Earl Scheib, and I picked out Basin Street Blue. Oh, it's a New Orleans color. God, that's going to be so great. And I went and picked it up, and it was turquoise, bright turquoise. I said, that's not my car. And they said, that's your car? I said, no, I picked this color. And they went, oh, that's faded. Well, you know, I ranted a little bit, and then I went off to work. And I think a lot, I think of, you know, this happened to Bill, and I never put it together until a few years ago. There was the coffee shop, and there was the bar, and the payphones were in between. And when Bill Wilson went to make the calls, because there was the bar, and that he could go back up to his room, or then the payphones were right there. And that's when, you know, he made the connection with Dr. Bob. Was he made that, he kept trying and trying and trying until he got somebody. Well, I had just one phone call to make to that sponsor, and she made me laugh. We talked about the car and how we were going to buff it down, and she made me laugh. And I went off to work, and I forgot about it. Because between me and me is me, and between me and my sponsor, thank God, is air, and they can see so much more clearly. And I've always had a sponsor louder than my head. Always had a sponsor louder than my head. Because when my head's going, I hear my sponsor's voice. I've had three sponsors in my sobriety, and they've all contributed, and I still hear what they tell me. Even the ones that aren't here. Janet, I don't know where she is anymore. Ginny is incredible. She's got almost 5 years of sobriety, and she had 21 and smoked pot and had to give up her years. And she has 5 years almost now. And Clancy's been my sponsor for 15 years. And so I've had three incredible sponsors that walked ahead of me and wanted the best for me. This guy that I fell in love with in Alcoholics Anonymous, and Nick and Donna know him, and they remember Al. And Al was charming, and he had 6 more months than me, and we got married. Boy meets girl on AA campus. And my dad walked me down the aisle, and my mom came, and my sisters, and we had an AA wedding, and it was just such a joy. I had gone home and made my amends. I had looked at my defects of character, finally. They were always his before I kind of, the lights went on and I saw my own. And what happened was my father looked at me at the end of my wedding day and said, Sharon, look at your life, you got it made. He was so impressed with you. He went to a meeting and bought a big book. My father's giving me approval. It was incredible. I just looked at my dad and I said, yeah, you're right, Dad, because I already had some of my own approval. And when Ginny sponsored me, she helped me soften and learn to become more of a woman. And she said, you know, you've made those amends to your father, but why don't you make those financial amends? Maybe it'll really mend that relationship. And I was like, I wasn't talking to you about financial amends. I was having a fight with my husband looking for some sympathy from you. And she said, why don't you call your dad and make those financial amends? And that's a sponsor who loves me more than I love myself, who keeps pushing me along. When the time is right, when I'm backed in a corner, aha, let's move on this one right now. And she had me call my dad up. And my dad, as I said, had come to the wedding, bought the book, and he's a reader, and he read it. So when I called my father, he knew what I was doing. I had asked my dad, I said, you know, Dad, I'm going to make these financial amends. I'm going to have to make payments. Do you think you can come up with a total? And he said, sure, Sharon, it's this much. And he gave me the total. He was ready for me. He had run a calculator tape, circled in and read at the bottom. And I'm sure he told my mom, look, if I'm out and Sharon gets to this part of the book, and if she stays sober, she will. There's the total. Just give it to her. I think it's page 78, Most Alcoholics Own Money, right there. So what happened was I got a new resentment. Ginny had me call him in 2 days, and he accepted my terms. He accepted the terms that I could come up with, and so I called her back. I said, yeah, I accept it. We're going to go with it. And she said, good. Then I want you to not be late. You might be the only example your father sees of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when anybody says that to me, I kind of straighten up. Because I want to be a good example. Even on my bad days, I want to be a good example. Now, it rains on the just and the unjust. And who am I to think I can judge who gets what? You know, I have to go out there and be of service. And so she said, I want you to put with that cold, hard cash that you're going to put in an envelope every month on time, a note about your life, so your dad can get to know you a little bit. And I said, he's got 3 other professional children who master's degrees, and he's proud of them. What does he want to know with the alcoholic? She said, do it anyway. So I did it anyway, because my sponsor checked up on me. They don't forget. And it was a little tiny note that turned into a letter, that turned into a Hallmark card, that turned into, you know, Father's Day cards were easier to do, remembering his birthday, and me and my dad kind of kept on the path. I went home once a year like I did to see my parents, and I kept sending these checks and these notes on time. And I remember at one point I wasn't sure I was going to have the the money, and I said, I don't know, I can't send it this month. And she said, you know what? He's going to put it into a trust fund for you so that when it's all over, he's going to give it back to you and you can buy that Jaguar you want, which I don't have yet. I just get to ride in one, Bob, but that's fun too. So I sent it early for about 3 months after that. smart woman. Between Christmas and New Year's, after doing this for about 4 years, my father picked up the phone, looked at my number, dialed me himself, and said, "Merry Christmas, Sharon. Your debt is free and clear. I don't want your money anymore." And I got off easy and light. I wasn't done. My dad didn't want any more money from me. Well, 4 years was plenty for him. But he added, "Don't stop sending me your notes." And I got to walk into a brand new relationship with my dad, guilt-free. And some other things happened about that time, too. I got to stand up straight and tall around the male population. Little did I know that I was feeling a little less than. Sense of innocence came back in my life that I had never experienced before. And so if you think you've drunk it all away, keep coming and keep working the steps. Because amazing things, amazing healings have happened. Things that I never thought I could have back or would want back in my life have come back. Al and I split up at 10 years of sobriety, and nobody got custody of the meetings. He got the newcomer in the back of the room, and I was pissed. I was really mad. That was when my sponsor started smoking pot, and I showed up at Clancy's door, and I said something like, "I don't think I like you very much. I don't know if you like me very much, but I need help." And he said, "Sit down, kid. We'll try it," and we've been trying it ever since. I had a baby who was a year and a half old. I had to go back to work. I was pissed off. I'd spike my hair up. I'd dye it white. I'd wear T-shirts that were like, you know, and I'd get in the car and drive 4 hours to a meeting and take newcomers with me whose eyes were spinning just like mine. I wouldn't let them stop and go to the bathroom. We couldn't stop and get a Diet Coke. We were intense. Springsteen to come on the radio, I'd sob. We'd have to like, oh, my God, you know, we'd have to find something else. And I was crazy. I was sitting in the front of the room with my legs out, my arms folded with that stay-away hair. And Pat Hodges walked by, and she said, "Look at Sharon. She's got 10 years. Do you want what she's got?" Oh, I heard her. So I turned myself into my sponsor, started working my steps. I gave away the spare keys to my ex-husband's car. I was going to drive it on the beach, wait for the high tide. I had a lot of plans. I gave up shoplifting. I was doing that at 10 years of sobriety. Made me go back to the Broadway and make amends at 10 years of sobriety. Very humbling experience. And I just went on. And I wasn't happy about it, and I started sponsoring this nun, and I had to go to church and wait for her because we go to lunch, and it's like, oh, God, they're talking about peace and love. Shut up. I don't want to hear it. And I was sitting in there, and one year, 1 month, and 14 days later, I felt the shift again. I was able to walk through the new door again. And I didn't get drunk, and I didn't throw hot coffee on them because my sponsor said I had to walk through it with dignity and grace so I could be an example to others. And I heard him. And I was free. I was free again to walk into a new life with a new view, because that's all the hallway is. It's called growth. And if you're in the hallway, look and see who's in it next to you. Find out why they're. Get out of your head for a minute. Take off the blinders. Open a window. Hang some art. Listen to some music. Your turn will come if you stay sober. The door will open onto a brand new view that you never knew before. It's just levels of love and levels of peace, and it just keeps going. After having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I have just never, ever, ever had to look back. And I am a more alcoholic. I don't know if you got that, but I am a more sober alcoholic, too. I stay here because I'm constantly reminded of the gift I have. I stay here because I get to rub next to miracles, shoulder to shoulder. Now, the lady whose hand was raised tonight, I hope I see you again. I hope you remember what it feels like tonight. I hope you don't forget, because you can have a brand new life full of love and innocence and dignity. I want to let you know that the ex-husband, his second wife and I are very good friends. And she's been his ex now for about 5 years, so we've been even better friends. I have a terrific 16-year-old son, and that's saying something right there, who looks at me and says, "God, Bob, you wasted a lot of time drinking." Billy knows. Billy spent some time with him. He's a great kid. I have a great life. It's full of a lot of challenges, and it's not what I always want, and I sponsor a lot of women, and I've made peace with almost everything in my past that I know of. My father was killed April 19th, 1999, and when I got the call, I felt really sad that I didn't get to say goodbye. But somebody looked at me and said, "Sounds like you had an awful lot of hellos." And it's attitude. Life is an attitude. I don't have a lot of choice about what's going to come down on me, but I have a lot of choice about my attitude. And I like to remember, I always wanted to do great things. You know, I went to the White House when I was 17, a citizenship trip. And I was chosen, two people from the state of Iowa, two people from every state were chosen, I was chosen. I was drunk in the White House, having tea with Lucy Bird and Linda Bird. I had met the boys from Virginia who fed me a lot of beer. I went back to the White House protesting in the 60s, you know, putting soap suds in the fountains and waving to the FBI building. And then I got to go back a couple of years ago to speak at something called the Capitol Breakfast and the Capitol Luncheon. And I got to walk back in there with dignity and grace and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, an example of what you've done with a hopeless, helpless alcoholic. My life is full. I always wanted to do great things. And I found out that the way to do great things is to do small things with a lot of love. And I try to do a lot of small things. I try to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people about me, as it says on page 77. That's where I found truth. I have a man in my life named Casey, and our life is full of passion, which is based on gratitude. A lot of gratitude. And I'm going to get on a plane. I'm going to go home tonight and put my head on my pillow. My little dog's going to put her face on in the morning and wake me up and look at me. And I'm going to say my simple, simple prayer, which is, "God, please help me to become half the person that my dog thinks I am." Thanks for having me.